please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Sean from Center Valley.
You know, my water bottle fits here. There we go. Good evening, everybody. My name's Sean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to speak for you tonight. It's an honor to speak in front of a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. When Mike texted me, I was hoping he was texting me to play golf, but it was it was actually to come here and speak, which you know, it's just an honor to do. Every time someone asks, I'm always more than honored to do so. I have a sober date. It's August 20th of 2021. My home group is the early morning group in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. We meet at, I don't know why they call it the early morning group. It's at 8:30 a.m. But that's in Emmaus, PA. But it's been you know, key in my sobriety. I feel like a lot of people have those meetings that they can't miss, and that's one that something big has to be going on for me to miss that meeting. It's just been crucial and very helpful. A lot of good sobriety in that meeting, so it'll always be a part of my program. So we're here to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'll start from the beginning, I guess. I grew up in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, obviously not too far from here. I'm the youngest of three brothers. My mother and father did their best to raise us well. They worked hard. You know, I recall early childhood. My father was a cable lineman. My mom was a paralegal. I know that my dad was the first one out the door and the last one to come home every day. I remember at a really young age being in my mom's office on Saturdays, because she would work long hours and she had to, you know, fill that responsibility and raise me and my brothers and make some money. And I would run around her office and she'd be working and I'd be destroying her coworkers' cubicles. But you know, growing up wasn't too bad. like I said, my parents did the best they could and they worked their butts off, for us. And I know that, you know, through my dad's tough job being a cable lineman, he had one wish and that was for me and my brothers to get into college. And, I never fully understood that growing up. And there are reasons for that. I should mention that my father was also an alcoholic. I come from an alcoholic household. That doesn't make me special. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't contribute to my disease. I mean, I'm sure it does in some ways, but, you know, I had a lot of red flags growing up. I saw the turmoil that the disease of alcoholism can cause. I was living proof of it growing up. I sheltered a lot of feelings because of it. And I never really got to know my father that well from it. You know, there was a lot of fear growing up, a lot of anxiety. Being the youngest of three, I did get away with a lot. So a lot of my story, I found myself either getting away with things or getting away from things. And that's kind of how I lived my life. And that carried on with me all through growing up, through my drinking career. You know, I could always get away with things, so that's what I did. But growing up, I didn't come across as troubled, I would say. I had a good group of friends. I still have childhood friends that I grew up with, that, you know, respect my choices to become sober and to be a sober person, to be an active member in AA, which I'm very thankful for. Wasn't really like a popularity contest growing up. I had a core group of friends. On the outside, I guess without talking about my home life, I seemed like I had my stuff together. School was just okay. I didn't excel too much. I kind of just, you know, floated by and got some good grades and, you know, had a mostly social upbringing. When I got to high school, I went to a larger high school. So, you know, with the amount of students that I went with, there were a lot of parents that weren't home just about every weekend. So I think partying and drinking became pretty normal pretty early for me. I hear speakers talk about the first time they drank and how they loved it and how it was this glamorous occasion of love. And for me, it wasn't that. I think the first time I got drunk, I convinced my older brother to let me go to his friend's sleepover. And I sat on the couch while they played video games and I drank, I think, 6 skunked warm Yinglings and threw up. And my brother walked me home, and we never talked about it again. So that's about as far as I got with my first time drinking. But the drinking and the social part of it in high school, you know, it came pretty naturally to me and the group of friends that I surrounded myself with. You know, drugs were a part of that too. I experimented with a lot of drugs in high school. Some experiments lasted longer than others, but you know, the common denominator was always drinking. I did, you know, habitually fall into the habit of drinking just about every weekend, and I would drink during the week when I could at an early age, probably about 16, 17, and a lot of that had to do with just getting away. I could get away from pain, from anxiety, from not wanting to be home pretty much ever. So that's what I did. I got away every chance I could. And didn't really have a whole lot of run-ins with the law when I was younger, so there weren't a lot of repercussions from my drinking. So to an alcoholic like me, I was just getting away with it. You know, it was just part of something that I did, and it was normal. But going through, you know, I kind of floated around with a few different crowds in high school. I was a little bit athletic, so I could play some sports. I started playing rugby, which kind of helped me get into college. So I got accepted to a college out in Western Pennsylvania, on a kind of a partial scholarship to play rugby. So when I went away to college, which is, you know, something that I thought my parents always wanted, so I thought I was doing the right thing. I never really knew why. I mean, admittedly, when I got to college, I didn't know what the hell I was going to do with my life, but I was finally permanently away. And if anybody knows anything about rugby, it's a very, let's just say that the culture is very heavily involved with drinking. So I could have a little fun with my friends, I could play some sports, and I could drink. And I was away from home, the place that I'd been trying to get away from pretty much my whole life. So that's what I did. And, you know, we drank a lot. Binge drinking was encouraged. And you know, when you hang out with guys with nicknames like Jackass and Scumbag and Tuna Fish, those guys don't really, they want to hear the story. Like that's what I did. I always try to impress people. They didn't, you know, there wasn't a care for the world. We just did what we did and we had fun, and we had a lot of good times, and there was a lot of regrettable times too, because I didn't know that this thing called alcoholism was just festering inside me. Everything that I thought was normal, you know, binge drinking was my way to get away from that. So that's what I did. So I kind of made my way through college. Again, partying, drinking a lot. You know, bar fights were normal. I wore it as a badge of honor. You know, breaking the law and getting away with it was normal. It was a badge of honor. You know, I lived for the stories the next day. I just wanted to hear what Sean did the next day. I wanted to be the one at the table that people were talking about, because that made me feel good. There was a time in college where I got my first DUI. Not a whole lot of glamour to the story. I left the bar, and I decided to go pick up my car that was across town. I was pulled over at about 11 p.m. A friend of mine lived across the street from the police station, so I was out by 1 a.m. and I went straight back to the party. Wasn't even an issue. You know, because I just wanted to keep going. There was really no slowing me down. I kind of felt like, to me, I had this like rock star persona that I had to upkeep all the time. And I needed to make sure that I was having fun. I needed to make sure that people were laughing, having a good time around me. And when I was young, it was okay. You know, nobody questioned. This is just Sean. This is who he is. But as I got a little older, left college, I did end up graduating. I think it took 5.5 years. There's no doctor or anything with that, just 5.5 years. So I bounced around. I was in college at Western PA, and I moved back to the Philadelphia area. And I bounced around a couple of places of employment, office jobs, first-time jobs out of college, places that I could pretty much show up hungover, sit at a desk, punch a couple keys, and nobody really questioned it. And, you know, again, there was no real repercussions. I was getting by. I was showing up, you know, hungover or not. I was getting my work done, so I felt like I was living life that I was supposed to live, right? And it came to a point where I wanted to get some kind of career on track, so I did switch jobs. And during that time, my father got real sick. He had a back surgery. He was laid off from his from the cable lineman job that he was working, and he was about 49, 50 years old. And he went into the hospital for a back surgery and never came out. So that hurt, you know, and I felt like, you know, there was all this stuff that I didn't get to talk to my father about, that I didn't get to experience with my dad, because it wasn't until that time after college when I really started to get to know him. I think he slowed down a little bit, and I think I started to speed up a little bit. But it was the first kind of any sort of semblance of a relationship I had with my dad. And then, you know, he got sick. He had this surgery. There are people in my family who would say that the surgery is what killed him. I don't believe that, knowing what I know now. I know that he is an alcoholic. I think the damage was already done. I think he got sick and, you know, his organs just couldn't handle some of the infections that he got, because the damage was done from the years of drinking. I found out later in life that he was in the fellowship. He tried. I know that he was going to the AA meetings at some point in my upbringing, but it was never talked about. So I have some sort of connection with him there now, which I'm very happy about. But back to what I was doing, you know, after he passed away, I went pretty numb to everything. I felt it for a few days. A few days before his funeral, I drank very heavily. I was drunk at his funeral. I was drunk carrying his ashes. And you know, that's a big regret for me. So I deal with that, and but I get through it. So after my dad passed, I did find a career that I thought I'd finally be in my space where I could finally start to slow things down, and the drinking may not be such a problem. You know, it wasn't going to be every other day. It was only going to be on the weekends. The weekends that start on Thursday. So I did that, and I started working this career in sales for a very large insurance company, and I was doing pharmacy benefit management, and I was traveling all over the country, and I felt like I had made it. I felt like my past was behind me. I didn't have to worry about anything. I was making good money, and I was just living that life that I thought was normal. And part of the job, you know, in sales, a big part of that was taking people out and taking clients out and kind of schmoozing them a little bit and taking them out to dinners and happy hours. And, there was a lot of conferences that I went to all over the country. And, you know, and a lot of these things, it was all ego driven for me. You know, I'm flying around the country, I'm wearing a suit and tie, I'm having cocktails, and I thought I was the coolest. I thought I was there. I thought I made it. And there's a part in Bill's story in the Big Book where he says, speaking about some jazz music playing in the background, and he's making good money, and he says, "I've arrived," or "I had arrived." And I know that feeling. I've been sitting there in a suit and tie, looking around, holding a cocktail, drinking, getting paid for it, and just thinking I was on top of the world, I'd arrived. So fast forward a little bit. I think I was with this job for about 6 months, and there was a conference in Ocean City, Maryland. Not a good place for an alcoholic. You know, the corporate card, taking clients out. I ended up, I was with my boss, and we had a client out one night, and we were drinking and, you know, having a good time with him. And when we had dropped him off, we started driving back to the hotel, and I think I was doing 55 and a 54 or whatever that song is. But I got pulled over and I got a DUI right there with my boss in the car. I'd been with the company for 6 months. And I remember getting a field sobriety test, and I could see my boss's face in the rear view. And I'm just thinking, all this is coming crashing down right now. Like, this is it. Like, you had your chance at this glorious job where you thought you were, you know, the coolest cat, and now you're flushing it all down the toilet. So needless to say, I was arrested. My boss walked home back to the hotel. The rental car that we had was impounded. I spent that night in jail. Probably didn't sleep much. I do remember having a conversation with the arresting police officer that night. He was from Downingtown. And I told him that I was from Philly. That's where I was living at the time. And in my drunken stupor, I thought it was a good idea to talk about the Eagles, which we did. And he stopped me and he said, "Do you have any idea how drunk you are right now?" And it kind of hit me. And he said, and I honestly don't remember what my blood alcohol level was, but he said, "You're having this coherent conversation with me. You should really look into getting yourself treated for alcoholism." And that was at, I think, 25 years old. So it didn't register, but I remember it now. And I'll always remember that. So what happened was, I went to my boss's hotel room the next day, and I knocked on his door and I said, "Am I fired?" And he said, "Come in, sit down, we'll figure this out." We had a flight to Columbus, Ohio in about 3 hours from when I got to his hotel room. And we talked about it, and he said, and he agreed with me that it was just an accident, that we took a client out. And I got pulled over for going 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. And that's just what happened. And we would tell a couple higher ups at the company, and we would sweep it under the rug. So that's what we did. So I got away with it, which is fine with me, right? So I did lose my license in the state of Maryland for that second DUI. I did what Maryland does, is some kind of ARD program, where I did a weekend away, basically just so I could show the judge that I was trying. And I think I took Amtrak down to Baltimore, which is where my only client was. And for 3 months, my license was suspended in Maryland, but it wasn't Pennsylvania. So I got away with it again, and it was fine. I kept my job. And I felt good about it. I genuinely felt good about it. And I genuinely convinced myself that it wasn't my fault. I just got pulled over for speeding and totally blacked out the whole part where I was drinking. I was sneaking shots of tequila at the bar by myself just so I could socialize with everybody else, because my social anxiety was pretty bad. And I didn't want to hang with these people. I just wanted to drink. So I went away for that weekend in Maryland, to show the judge that I was a good boy. And, I remember getting home that Sunday, and I was living with my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And I said, "You know what? Maybe I shouldn't drink," because it was kind of this crash course, on just drinking and basically kind of like a scared straight. You know, you're going to end up back here. You're going to end up with another DUI if you keep drinking. And I thought about it for, I don't know, maybe 24 hours. So, life didn't change too much after that, you know, because I still have my job, I'm still making money. So I continued on. And I lived that life that I thought I was supposed to live, and I was able to drink all week long for work, pretty much. You know, not that everybody that I worked with was doing that, but I was, and in my mind it was acceptable. And then I would go out on the weekends and do my binge drinking again, and hose the barns out basically every Friday and Saturday night, and that's pretty much how I lived for many years when I lived in Philly, and this is when we referred to ourselves as Dinks, my wife and I, dual income, no kids. So I didn't have really a whole lot of responsibilities. I was just a young guy in my 20s making money and drinking. Fast forward a little while more. You know, I somehow held on to my job doing the bare minimum for a while. Still drinking a lot. And I would always tell myself, you know, when you get married, you'll slow down. When you have kids, you'll slow down. When you buy that house, you'll slow down. And it never happened. It never happened. So I continued to drink, you know, I would drug a bit behind my wife's back. She had no idea how much I was drinking, at work. And, you know, my ego was huge because I still thought that I was just this young guy making money. Alcohol was always the common denominator in every one of my wrongdoings. All the drugs I did, all the cheating I did, all the lying I did, it was all just fueled by alcohol. And I was totally blind to it. I just thought this is life and this is how I'm going to live it. And I was okay with that. And, you know, the house did come, the kids did come, and I never slowed down. And get me up to, about 2019. There was this thing called a pandemic that happened. And, for somebody that was already going 100 miles per hour, I was totally backed into a corner. My disease had me full in control. I could no longer go out and pretend that I was just having a few drinks when I already had a half a bottle of vodka at home. I could no longer travel and go see people and drink all in between every one of my meetings and drink by myself in my hotel room. All of that was gone, but the alcoholism was speeding up. It was pretty much, you know, it's hard to say when it went full-fledged, but it went hard and it went fast. I began drinking, I began drinking daily during the work day at home because I was working from home. I had a big meeting with a bunch of higher-ups at 10 a.m. So I started drinking Bloody Marys at like 8 o'clock that morning, and it went great. And that was enough for me, you know, to keep on doing it. I got off the phone and I had a couple text messages from some higher ups that I really respected saying, hey, that was a great job. You really put that thing together. So I thought, this is easy. You know, I can do this every day. So I did. And, slowly but surely, I just began drinking with everything that I did. Every morning I'd wake up, sneak a few shots of whiskey or vodka or whatever I had. Every errand that I ran had to start at the liquor store, to the point where the guy at the liquor store, he knew me as Yukon Sean because I would get little bottles of Yukon Jack all the time. Probably like three, I don't know, I would hop around to different liquor stores. So three, at least at his liquor store, it was two or three times a day I would stop in and get three or four bottles. So I was drinking probably 10 to 15 Yukon Jack airplane bottles a day, and that was, you know, before probably 3 p.m. So it started about 8 a.m. And, that's no way to live. And I learned that really quickly. But, you know, in the meantime, I was picking my kids up from daycare drunk. I was going to the gym drunk. I was going to the grocery store drunk, and just about anywhere I could go, I was going drunk because I had to. I had to stop at the liquor store and get my shots in. I tried to keep a social life. People didn't really catch on because I had that discretion. I had that curtain of the pandemic where nobody really knew what I was doing. But when you live with someone, your significant other catches on pretty quickly. You know, over a couple years, that couple years during the pandemic, I basically became a shell of a person. I was antisocial. I was having anxiety attacks probably once a week. You know, just not sleeping. I would wake up at, you know, 3 a.m., twitching, sweating, just couldn't wait for the break of day so I could start drinking again. And that same attitude came back, you know, where I would say, you know, after the kids I'll stop, after the house I'll stop. It became, okay, in the new year I'll stop. This weekend I'll slow down. Next month I'll slow down. Next month I'll stop. And then next month would turn into 3 months, and I just kept convincing myself, just keep going. And you know, before I know it, I had no say in the matter. I was full-blown, a shaking alcoholic. You know, I had to start drinking at 7 a.m. just about every day for a good, better part of a year. I couldn't even put the password in the keyboard on my work computer without drinking because I was shaking so bad. I couldn't scroll through my phone. I could barely hold a conversation. So in May of 2021 is when I kind of sort of started to stop. I started going to AA meetings, and I was going drunk. I had no idea what AA was or what AA was trying to teach me or trying to show me what I could have. It was too new to me, and I was too naive. I was too inebriated. You know, nothing was clicking. So I made a couple half-assed attempts, to go to AA, and it didn't, home life was terrible. I put my wife through hell. If she suspected that I was drinking, I would, you know, spit venom at her. I would, you know, deny, and find a way to get out of the house to go start drinking again. You know, my kids were probably terrified of me. They were 2 and 4 at that time because they didn't know who their dad was. I was drunk all the time. I put on the happy face when I was around them, and I tried to be a good dad. I wanted to be a good dad, but I couldn't. In June of 2021, I lost my job. The jig was kind of up. My boss called me out. He asked me if I was on drugs. I told him no. Why are we even having this conversation? A few weeks later, I got canned. And even that wasn't enough. You know, I didn't tell my wife right away because I wanted to keep drinking. And when I did finally tell her, I started to look, I was looking for a new job already, drunk. I interviewed for a few jobs drunk. They didn't hire me. But I did my best to tell them that I was, you know, I was the next best thing, and I was going to tell them how to run their company. Nothing was really working. And I went to a neighbor's house, and they were doing like a Taco Tuesday thing. And, you know, I show up, and I knew that one of my neighbors owned a landscaping company. And I casually said, how's business going? And he said, it's pretty crappy. I just lost one of my foremen, and he's my best guy, and he's leaving in 2 weeks. And I said, well, I just lost my job. I can landscape. And, right away he said, sure. He said, can you come in next Monday? Start. And I said, absolutely. And I didn't know it at that time, but that was one of the biggest blessings of my sobriety. It truly, truly was. So I started landscaping with this company, and, for some reason I thought that it was going to be like this, you know, kind of outdoor construction job, landscaping, we'd have beers afterwards, but it wasn't like that at all. These guys were Christian guys. They did have beer in the fridge at work, but I never partook in the beer after work because I had to go to the liquor store after work because I needed the stronger stuff. But anyway, I was with this company for about whatever that was, 30 days, a month and a half, and I had another several weeks where, you know, the fights were happening at home still. I was getting kicked out of the house. You know, if I showed up drunk, I wasn't allowed there. But, you know, because my big cozy job where I traveled all over the place, I had all those hotel points. So if I got kicked out, I was going to Philly, and I would just party by myself from Friday to Sunday, staying in the hotel, using my points, using what little money I had left of my own. And that happened, I think, 3 or 4 weekends in a row while I was still working, while I was working this landscaping job. And a Thursday rolled around and my wife and I were going at it again, so I was sleeping in the guest bedroom. And she sent me a text. And all it was in the text was a link to a recovery center. And I think I saw treatment in the name. And I didn't even click on it. I just replied to her, okay, I'll go tomorrow. Because I was so beat up, I was so sick of the life that I was living, even though, like, somewhere in my alcoholic brain, I still thought that I was living this glamorous life. I was a total wreck. I was, you know, shaking to my core if I wasn't drinking. I was miserable to be around. I was a shell of a person. My eyes were glazed over. I was beet red all the time from drinking. I probably put on like 60 pounds. I hear stories of people that lost weight drinking. I don't know what they were drinking, but I was very unhealthy. And for somebody like me to become that unhealthy, I'm not saying this to like pat myself on the back or anything, but I had a passion for health and things like that. I graduated with a health degree and I tried to pursue that, but you know, when this disease has a control of you, like it did on me, it put my blinders on to everything. So I agreed to that, and it wasn't because my wife at the time, yeah, she had some say in it, but I was throwing up the white flag. I was done. I couldn't do it anymore. I said, I'll go tomorrow. So I went into work the next day and I worked a full day and I talked to that boss at the landscaping job and, I told him what was going on at the end of the day. And, he gave me a hug and he said, go do what you got to do. You have a job when you get back. And, that meant so much to me and I didn't know it at the time again because I was, my judgment was so cloudy. You know, I thought I was going to go to rehab. I was going to be a new man. I was going to come back and get back into my career. But, it was while I went away to treatment. He was cutting my grass for me. He paid me as if I was working 40 hours a week and I didn't even realize it. My wife told me when I was in treatment that he was paying me. So I feel like I owe him a lot, but you know, if I talk to him about it today, he said, I'm just doing what God would have wanted me to do for another person. So I went into treatment and I really wanted to get better. I really did. So I took it very seriously. I had a life to get back. I had a family to get back to and I didn't want to be a drinker anymore. So I took it very seriously. I went away for 30 days and then I did another 30 days at a PHP. And, so I was away from my family for that 60 days. I think I saw them once. And that was hard. That was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. It wasn't, you know, there's obviously a lot of thoughts that go through your head when you sober up. But you know, I did have that fear of what life's going to be like and how are people going to see me? You know, having the ego that I had, it was a big deal to go away and to get help for myself. But I did, and I felt good about it. I felt great about it. I finally took that crash course on AA when I was in treatment, and I fell in love with it. You know, I was the guy that wanted to talk about it all the time in treatment, and I wanted to, you know, do the next right thing. So when I got out, I wanted to hit the ground running, so I did. And, you know, I started going to every meeting I possibly could. I felt like I had everything under control. Fly here. Do you hear that? So I felt like I had everything under control and I admit it, like, you know, I get it. I had no control over this thing. It had control over me. I was powerless. And I would like to say, you know, I hear people say they're the one-time winners with recovery or treatment. And I don't think I could ever say that. I know I can never say that. Because I just, the way this disease has a hold on me, I know it could happen at any time. I could go right back into that lifestyle. And I almost did. I was a big cleaner in early sobriety. So when I was, you know, getting my life back in order back at home, I was cleaning my garage one day and I was cleaning up my four-wheeler and I was looking for the registration and I opened up the wet box in the back, or the dry box. And there was my old buddy's four bottles of Yukon Jack. And this is within 90 days of my sobriety. and the four bottles are there, and I'm alone in my garage. My wife's probably 30 feet away inside, and every single thing that everybody told me, call somebody, tell your wife, throw it out. Every single one of those thoughts came through my head within a minute. Just a million thoughts came through my head. And I ripped one open and took a shot. And I ripped another one open and I took a shot. So I drank all four of them within about 30 seconds. And I was crushed. I was so disappointed in myself, like to tears. Because that's when I was powerless, you know. I told myself over and over again that I was powerless. But until I was face to face with that old companion and knowing how strong it had a hold on me, I was devastated for a guy with an ego like me. Like I said, like a million thoughts went through my head, and I just ripped them down. And soon after that, the thoughts started coming to me again. What didn't you do? Why didn't you do it? You should do it now. So I got my ass to a meeting right away, and I told on myself. You know, when they ask, has anybody had a problem with alcohol today? I burst into tears, and I explained what I had just done. And I just, it was sad, you know, after all that work that I thought I'd put in treatment and recovery, and I thought I had it. My brain thought, you know, my brain told me that I did have it, but not the way this thing had a hold of me. But doing that was another big blessing. When that meeting wrapped up, I was walking out the door, head down, and there was a guy at the door, and he said, "Hey, my name's Steve. Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he goes, "Well, what are you doing now?" I said, I don't really know. I don't got much to do." So he said, "We're gonna go sit down, and I'm gonna take you through some steps in the big book, and I'm gonna be your sponsor." He said, and this is. I think it's a true act of God. He wasn't even supposed to be at that meeting. He came to the meeting to get a coffee cup that he left at the previous meeting. And he heard me say that and he stayed. That's the kind of people that are in AA. That's the kind of people that are in this fellowship, the people that want to help you out, the people that are there for you, the people that understand you. And that's the way I had to learn it. You know, God wasn't done with me when I got out of treatment. I had to punish myself one more time. So I worked with Steve for a couple months, and I wasn't the best sponsee to him. I do owe him an amend still, because I did lose communication with him, but I didn't lose touch with the program. But he taught me some things that morning that will stick with me through the rest of my life. And then, you know, I'm happy that I did it. I'm happy that I went to that meeting and spoke up, because that's what I'm supposed to do. And in this program, they tell you do what you're supposed to do. Do what people tell you to do. So as long as I keep doing what people tell me to do, I start to learn what the right things are to do. So I was missing a sponsor when I had that moment in my garage. I was missing the program. I knew it, but I didn't have it. And some time went by, and I started getting back into hitting meetings. I met another sponsor who has been so great to work with, and he's taught me a lot. He taught me a lot of the great AA sayings that I know today. I have things highlighted in my big book that I'll never forget. You know, and a lot of things that I can look back on and realize how many blessings I had in just that first decision to go to treatment, and to have the guys around me that I had around me, both in the fellowship and in my work. You know, that this boss that took care of me, that life that I thought I was supposed to get back to, that career. I mean, when everything finally started to click, and I really started to focus on my recovery and put that first, like, the hell with another job. Why would I jeopardize anything that I have going on right now? So that's what I did. I still work for him today. You know, I'm loyal to him. He's been, you know, if I could give him an award, I would. But, again, he wouldn't tell me, he wouldn't say he's doing it for any notoriety or anything. He's just doing it because he's a good guy. You know, I realize a lot of things that happened in my life and in my story that were blessings outside of that. You know, when my dad passed away, I held on to his hand, as he took his last breaths and they took him off of life support. And I didn't know it at the time, but there were parts of the program that were working for me even then. I told him that I'm sorry if I didn't do what he wanted me to do, and I forgave him for all those nights that he came home drunk. I forgave him for, you know, the relationship that we had growing up, and I knew that it could have been better. And I'm at peace with that now, and just knowing that, you know, he tried in the program, and, you know, I can take a little piece of him with me in the program is a great blessing for me. And I didn't know it at that hospital bed that day, but that was, you know, part of my working the steps started right there. And you know, there are several other things that have happened, in the last few years that have just been such a blessing, and it's all been from this program. I've met some great friends. I've lost some friends that, frankly, I don't really need. You know, there's a past and a part of me that is probably better off dead, and I'm okay with that. I'm at peace with it. You know, I can still laugh and have a good time, without alcohol. I can play golf. I can fish and do all those things without alcohol. It wasn't easy in early sobriety. I think, you know, I had a lot of emotional sobriety to work on in my first year. Cause I was kind of a wreck. You know, even though I was floating by, going to meetings, I was, all the emotions that I had going on from all those years of drinking, you know, it was a good 20 years of drinking heavily, at the very least, every single weekend, you know. So when you have a couple years of sobriety and you're still trying to figure out the past 20 years, it's very emotional. But it got better, and it gets better every day. You know, I have a morning routine now. I talk to God every morning. I thank Him every morning. I read AA literature every morning. I read my Bible every morning. I'm present for my family. I think my kids like me. It's pretty cool. So I try to be the best that I can for them, but, you know, I got to put me first. You know, as selfish as we are as alcoholics, as I am as an alcoholic, I thought that was the hardest concept to understand. How do I put myself first? You know, I'm supposed to not be selfish, but when it comes to sobriety and recovery, I have to be, because the only way I'm going to be a good man to my wife, a good husband to my wife, a good father to my children, a good brother to my brothers, son to my mom, is working my recovery and working my program. So that's what I do. There's just so many good things I could say about AA that, you know, it's gotten me so far, and there's still so much to do. You know, thinking about the fun things to do, I was talking to, I called a friend of mine that I actually used to party with, and this is just kind of a side story as I wrap up here. But I called an old friend of mine who's an interventionist now, and I was driving home and playing golf, with some friends, and he's like, well, how does that make you feel when you're doing the things that you used to do drinking? Like, does it make you feel strange? And I thought about it, and I said, you know, that first year of sobriety, I would have hated it. I probably wouldn't have even done it. But now I just, you know, to know that all those things that I was afraid of, I can still find so much joy in. You know, I just think to myself, what the hell was I afraid of? You know? Things are good. And that's how things are now. And that's all I can say. I thank you again for letting me speak tonight. It's an honor. I know we all have different stories, and if there's something from mine that you can pick up or relate to, that's all I can pray for. But thank you for having me.